Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Developing Developers for another episode in the How-To series. This series will walk through the how-tos of all things development. Today, we are going to learn about how to read and understand an AIA contract. If you're unfamiliar with what an AIA contract is, AIA stands for the American Institute of Architects, and these contracts are documents they prepare that define the relationships and terms involved in design and construction projects. These contracts can get super complicated, or at least they can appear that way, which is why I have invited Alicia Zambelli, who practices real estate law as a partner at Walter Haverfield, to walk us through how to read an AIA contract. So thank you for joining me today, Alicia.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we get into the specifics of an AIA contract, I'd love to hear what your career experience has been and what you're doing in your current role.
My undergraduate degree is from Cornell University, and then I attended the Ohio State University Law School. And as a second-year law student, I was hired by the Wiles Boyle firm. Bruce Burkholder is one of my mentors, and he's a fantastic real estate attorney, and saw the Cornell undergraduate degree. He already had a very robust restaurant practice, and my undergraduate degree is actually in the School of Hotel Administration, so I have a hospitality background, so he thought it could be a good fit. He hired me. I worked at the Wiles Boyle firm for 2 years as a law clerk and then was hired on as an attorney. I passed the bar exam in 2007 when real estate was obviously in the toilet. And so another amazing real estate attorney, Tom Hart, who was with our firm for some time, he's the former executive director of the Building Industry Association of Central Ohio. He was in-house for Dominion Homes. Tom joined our firm at the same time I was taking the bar exam. So I came back and started working with Tom. And my first real estate work was doing bank workouts for builders in 2007. So it was a very stressful time for the Building Industry Association. And it did, however, on the positive side, forge a lot of long, enduring relationships. It really brought, you know, us and our clients together. We were on the same team. There was a lot of appreciation for the help. And most of them, thankfully, in some iteration or other, weathered the storm and are still building today. So that was a very meaningful experience as a brand new attorney. And then over the years, the Wiles Boyle firm in 2013 merged with the Isaac Brandt firm, forming Isaac Wiles, and continued to practice real estate law with Bruce, and also Tom and Molly Gwynn, who's an excellent zoning and land use attorney, and just recently joined the firm of Walter Haverfield. My mentor Bruce is starting to kind of wind down his practice a bit, and it's a great large Cleveland-based firm. Just a really exciting opportunity to expand the Columbus office, and my own personal vision is creating a small boutique real estate, construction, zoning and land use, transactional business firm. And so that's what I'm working on today. My practice is nearly all real estate. I do also, interestingly enough, do liquor permit work because Bruce, Bruce actually, as a new lawyer, had this, you know, immense restaurant practice and was tired of farming out the work. And so said, figure it out. And so I did. And so I do that work as well. Our paralegal, Regan Pikowski, who's amazing, she came with me to Walter Haverfield. She largely heads up my liquor permit practice. So, wow. You know, just interesting and complimentary to my practice. So do a lot of commercial leasing, but then also do a lot of contractual work and development work.
That's awesome. And that's it's good to know all that experience because you do just have such a wide array of experience. And it sounds like a lot of great mentors that have brought you to where you are today. And so I think that will serve us well in this episode. But I know I've gotten to work with you. It's been great. And although we're going to focus on AIA contracts today, what other documents maybe would you work with a developer on to complete for a project?
Sure. And there's a lot. This is, a pretty concise list, not all inclusive, but the basic documents would be a purchase and sale agreement for acquisition of the ground itself. And so obviously, the developer would be working with a seasoned real estate broker up until that point, getting to the letter of intent. state. Sometimes brokers involve us with a negotiation of the LOI to some degree, and other times not. It just kind of depends on the project. So purchase and sale agreement, and then oftentimes there's a development agreement, especially if there's a joint venture of some sort, if there's multiple players in a project, and one developer is doing the infrastructure and another is doing, you know, something else. The development work can be split among various parties. So the development agreement is the specifics of who's putting in the sewer, who's putting in the roads, who's putting in the electric, who all of those things. Oftentimes in the development process, almost always, easements are required to establish the necessary utilities to the site. So easement agreements are something that the attorneys work with developers. And then in the acquisition process, there's also the loan documents. So review of those specific documents and comments to the same. And then there will be the title commitment and review of the title commitment in acquisition of the property to make sure there are no exceptions to title that would prohibit the desired use of the property or otherwise, impede use. And then the closing itself, so review of all of the closing documents and any associated title company-related documents. And then there's a whole other branch of the practice of law that is extremely specialized, and that is in regards to the entitlement process, so zoning and land use. Mm-hmm. And as I said, Molly Gwynn and then Tom Hart, both excellent zoning and land use attorneys. I would always encourage a developer to work with a specialized attorney for zoning and land use. The entitlement process is very challenging these days. A lot of the municipalities are very reluctant to approve projects, and it really can make or break a project having the right attorney working on it. And then there is another area of law also extraordinarily specialized, and that is regarding tax incentives. So TIFs, tax increment financing, new community authorities, community revitalization areas, those are all its own animal. It's something that I stay away from and let the experts handle. Yeah. Same as zoning and land use. It's just a very nuanced area of law, but also very important at making projects work.
Yeah. No, I think that those are all important for developing developers to understand and know so that they don't miss a beat when they're trying to dive into a development project. And AIA contracts, a lot of developers or developing developers might not be aware of. It's something that I know is heavier on the construction side, but I think they're important to understand and they seem really complicated. So I'm excited that we're going to dig into that a little bit more today. But from a high level, could you explain what an AIA contract is and just the purpose of one?
Sure. So the American Institute of Architects has developed a form bank. It's been around for 134 years. There are over 200 documents available for purchase online relating to all different contractual relationships relating to construction. They have different series. So there are, I believe, six series, A, B, C, D, E, possibly F. Each series has to do with something different. So for developers, the A series, they're the owner-contractor-based contracts. Those are the most frequently used. And for developers, sometimes the B series, those are owner-architect contracts. Those are sometimes also utilized. But for our purposes today, we're going to talk about, in my opinion, the most frequently used AIA contracts. Mm-hmm. And just so they're a good starting basis of negotiations for the contractual obligations of the parties in a development deal. They are developed by a combination of owners, architects, contractors, general contractors, subcontractors. But please keep in mind, depending on what side of a deal you're on, they do favor architects, as you might imagine, the American Institute mm-hmm. of Architects. They favor architects for sure, trying to limit liability for them. And they do favor the contractor more so than the owner. So the contracts we're going to talk about today are the A141. That is the owner and design build contract. And these are for large design build projects where the owner contracts with a single entity to provide both design and construction. Doesn't mean that the design builder won't engage an architect. Usually they do. Usually it's a standalone third-party architect, but the contract is between the design builder and the architect, usually, you know, before entering into the contract with the owner. And so it's sort of a one-stop shop, if you will, for the owner, and preferable to many owners. And what we see the most, it is a standalone contract, meaning that document and the requisite exhibits, Exhibit A being the amendment that contains most of the cost provisions of the deal, and then Exhibit B being the insurance provisions of the deal. Those things can stand alone and no further general terms and conditions are required. The other document we see quite a bit is the A201. That is the general conditions of contract for construction. And for some of the smaller contracts that you might be involved with, by way of example, I'm also going to mention the A401. That is the contractor and subcontractor agreement. For smaller, shorter documents, for smaller projects, they do tie into the A201 general conditions contract. So there are some contracts that you use both of those documents. And then, as I mentioned, the A141 is a standalone. So those are the ones I think developers typically see the most. But for our purposes of sort of most important provisions to keep in mind, we're going to walk through the A141 today.
Okay, perfect. And just to clarify one thing, so the differentiators between all of the contracts are who they're between. So
correct. It's the parties, and you can literally Google AIA list of contracts, and you can tell by the actual titles of the agreement. They're very straightforward. Standard form of agreement between owner and design builders. You know, general conditions of the contract, subcontractor contractor agreement. So they differentiate who's involved, and then it's also based on the scope of the project. Some are limited form contracts for smaller projects, and others are more robust contracts for larger scale projects.
Okay, that makes sense. And we can just start digging in here. I know there's a lot to it, so you can kind of take it however you want. But let's just walk through how to read and understand this contract.
Sure. And I'm going to start by just saying, first of all, the best thing that anyone can do is just, you know, give it their best shot just to use common sense and read it. Mm-hmm. But with the understanding that it is also recommended that you engage an attorney to negotiate this on your behalf. Your construction team will have a lot of added value, and a lot of this is, you know, you're going to lean heavily on them for the substantive concepts and making sure the exhibits are correct and the exhibits properly encompass the scope of work and the terms of the deal. But then there is legalese to the contract that you really do need an attorney who does this on a regular basis to review on your behalf. Mm-hmm. One thing I'll say about the AIA 141 is we've been using this a lot for projects where a developer is building a warehouse building. It could be any type of building. But that there are various scopes of work then after the shell building is complete. And what's nice about this is we've been using multiple Exhibit A's to differentiate those scopes of work. So the design builder who is building the building for the owner completes the shell under the AIA itself, and then whatever scope of work for the owner will be Exhibit A1. But then there can be multiple scopes. There can be an Exhibit A2, which is a tenant-specific build-out. And you could do, if it's by way of an example, like a flex use or a warehouse building, and there's four bays, you could literally have A1, which is the build-out, the building core shell itself, and then you could have A2, 3, 4, 5 that are individual scopes of work by the same design builder and the same architect For the tenant build-out work, and that can work very well. It's recommended, in fact. Just anytime you can keep the architect the same and the contractor the same, it tends to create harmony in completion of the work and cost savings for everyone involved. So we always encourage, if the owner already has an end user identified as the tenant, to really push for utilization of the same design builder for the build out, just to keep everything cohesive. So we'll get started. And as we go through the document, I'm going to just mention some elements, comments to the provisions that would be beneficial if you're on the design builder side of things. So design builder being the developer and the developer having utilized the third-party architect and provided the plans for the work. Other provisions I'm going to note would be beneficial if you represented the owner, and it's something to consider. So let's just get started. You'll note that this document is largely tied to exhibits, and that they're going to be construction drawings, and they're going to be a construction timeline, and you just need to appropriately identify those within the body of the document itself. And this is where you lean heavily on your construction team, making sure you have the most up-to-date and accurate drawings and schedules to attach. And that can it can sometimes be challenging because of just the timing of all this. One other thing I'll note is that a lot of times this document is in the midst of being negotiated while there is site work that is necessarily being completed. And so we usually handle that by way of a pre-construction agreement. So we will identify things like demolition or excavation or site clearing, things that can be done while the parties are negotiating and finalizing this document so as not to hold up the project. And we simply handle that by a separate standalone document talking about the obligations and the pricing concerned with that work while this is being finalized. So you'll see in section 1.1.6, budget for work, and usually what we're seeing for these documents and will be tied into Exhibit A, mostly gross maximum price contracts. With the understanding, while it is a gross maximum price, it is always subject to change orders, and there are usually some other carve outs for the gross maximum price as it relates to elements that are beyond the reasonable control of either party. And I think what to keep in mind in negotiating this document is what's quote-unquote fair. And I know that's not a favorable term under the law or, you know, for lawyers. But truly, in this type of agreement, it is finding the appropriate risk allocation between the owner and the design builder. If the legal requirements of construction were to change during the pendency of this contract and the completion of the work, what's fair? Well, usually what's fair is the parties split those costs. And then what happens if a unknown latent issue with the site comes to fruition, comes to light? What's quote unquote fair? Well, it's not usually fair unless, of course, that the design builder doesn't use proper diligence and care in evaluating the situation. If something truly beyond the reasonable control or anticipation of the parties occurs, we tend to push for allocation of those types of expenses to be allocated equally or some balance, not so completely borne by one party. Yeah. That's, yeah. Again, with the caveat that both parties are utilizing appropriate diligence in making sure that doesn't happen. So let's look at 1.1.7, very key component of the contract. These are the milestone dates and substantial completion, certain phases. The more information, the better in these types of provisions, the most important being the substantial completion date. One thing to really keep in mind is as a developer, if you have already identified the end user for the space, if their leases, or even if you're in a letter of intent, negotiation, or you have a signed letter of intent, to tie what is required by the AIA contract for substantial completion, making sure it meshes with the requirements of the owner as landlord to the end user tenant as far as required delivery of possession date, mm-hmm. and building in some cushion to the best of your ability with the understanding that's not always as possible as you would like. One of the key considerations I would advise for either party, I mean, especially for the owner, because the owner under the leases will be held accountable usually to the tenant for either abated rent or a termination right for failure to timely provide delivery of possession. So what I always recommend considering is liquidated damages. We'll get to that a little bit later in the document, but within reason, creating that incentive for the design builder to get the project done timely so as to not result in the owner acquiring liquidated damages themselves under the subject leases. And if you're able to show the design builder actual damages under the lease, it's usually a pretty reasonable conversation. Mm-hmm. So as we move through the document, you're just laying out who are the players in the project, the architect, the consultants, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, fire protection, all the subcontractors, and the project team and the points of contact there. One thing I will note, Section 1.3 regarding dispute resolution, it allows the parties to decide whether it's going to be arbitration or litigation. In every other area of the law other than construction, I don't favor arbitration because it's very expensive and it's a very slow process. But as it relates to construction, judges and juries don't know anything about construction at all. So if the dispute becomes delay of completion or construction defects, they're just not well equipped to decide that type of case. So for these contracts, I would recommend arbitration as the choice of dispute resolution. I'm into Section 1.4.5, instruments of service. If you are representing an owner, and if you're representing a design builder, it would not be an unreasonable request. The concept that the instruments of service, so the plans and specifications created by the architect, that they are going to be the property of the owner, and the owner reserves the right to use them for future projects so long as they provide reasonable compensation to the design builder, because the design builder would owe that to the architect. So you want, as an owner, you would want to, you know, you in theory, paid for these plans through mm-hmm. the total compensation of the design builder. You want the ability to use them again as long as you give proper compensation.
Absolutely.
So as we talked about a brief time ago, I'm into Section 2.1.1. This is the perfect area of the document to the extent that there is work being performed prior to execution. Pursuant to a pre-construction agreement, this would be the proper area of the document to reference that and the date of that document to then tie it into this document, just mm-hmm. a cross-reference there.
Do you see pre-construction agreements more often than not in the process of doing an AIA?
I do, okay. Just because the negotiation process can be lengthy mm-hmm. at times, and just everyone is eager as soon as the construction loan has closed and the acquisition of the property has closed to get started.
Yep.
And so usually it's not a substantial amount of work, but it's clearing, it's mm-hmm. excavating, it's those types of things, demolition if necessary. But yeah, it is a frequently used agreement in construction in conjunction with this for development. I'm into 3.1.6. If you are representing an owner or if you're on the builder side, it is not an unrealistic request. Striking the last sentence of that provision, again, this is an architect-friendly document, and it basically states that the services of the architect is only on the behalf of the design builder, and basically that the owner can't depend and rely on those services. Well, obviously, it is not an unrealistic expectation for the architect to use the proper standard of care in performing its services, regardless of the end user. So that is a typical request that be struck if you're representing an owner. So I'm into section 3.1.13.2. This is royalties, patents, and copyrights. There's quite an onus on the owner as it relates to violation of trademarks relating to the architect's plans, copyrights.
Okay.
As an owner, you're paying quite a bit of money to hire a very reputable design builder to complete your project for you. And as part of that hiring and payment, there needs to be an expectation that the design builder is going to use the appropriate level of diligence to manage the project. So one recommendation for this concept in the document, and not to be I wouldn't – if you're the design builder, it would not be an unrealistic ask by the owner that if – To put the onus back on the design builder, that if a third party makes any sort of claim of a violation and infringement of intellectual property rights like plans, the design builder needs to bring that to the attention of the owner. Then it becomes the owner's choice to proceed despite this, you know, possible claim or not. And it would only be upon the design builder bringing to the attention of the owner this concern and the owner deciding to move forward regardless of the concern, that this indemnification, meaning owner being responsible for reimbursing the design builder for any damages relating to an alleged infringement of intellectual property rights, would then become the owner's responsibility. Section 3.1.14.1, this is indemnification. So For those that are sort of new to legalese, indemnification is the concept of one party defending, indemnifying, and hold harmless, meaning paying for the other party if there are claims, damages, losses, litigation, including attorney's fees arising from the subject transaction. And what is typical is to accept out the negligence and willful misconduct of the other party. So this provision is drafted, is very design builder friendly. If you are representing the design builder, if you were the design builder, leave it alone. If you're the owner, take a look at it and make sure to accept out some of that negligence and willful misconduct, because it's sort of a blanket indemnification in favor of the design builder.
Quick question just on the language in this. So there's a standard language, and then you can make changes to that through an attorney or like on the owner side or the design build side.
Exactly. Okay. Right. So yeah, the proposed verbiage is very much a starting off point. Mm-hmm. And I've seen any differing degree. I've seen very nominal comments, and I've seen people basically rewrite the document. And what I would say is, it's a pretty well done document, and it's pretty widely accepted by most parties that work with it frequently. So you're not going to win. If you try to rewrite the AIA document, you're going to lose, and you're going to spend a lot of money trying to do it. So pick your comments carefully and stick to the best of your ability, substantive deal points, things that really, like, you know, move the needle as far as risk allocation, liquidated damages. I would save my comments for that. Just rewriting it for the sake of rewriting it, folks that do this frequently are not going to agree to that.
Okay.
3.1.15.3, this is as it relates to obligations after an assignment of the contract. If you're on the owner's side of things, take a look at that, because it's overly friendly to the design builder, letting them basically off the hook after an assignment. So that is worth consideration. The contract, and I know it's long, but it is, I think, pretty straightforward, actually, spelling out the processes and obligations of both of the parties as it relates to change orders, submittals, and it is well done. So One thing to keep in mind is the allocation of cost savings. Something to create an incentive for the design builder, for both parties, but especially for the design builder to value engineer projects, mm-hmm. is splitting any cost savings off of the budget with them. And it could be split 50-50 between the owner and the design builder. It could be 75-25. I see it both ways frequently. And then usually I do see that any cost savings as it relates to deposits, that always goes just back 100% to the owner.
Okay.
I'm into section 8.2.4. This is delays and extensions of time. So this is the perfect location in the document to put in a liquidated damages provision. So if no end user has been identified, if it can be a deal breaker. I mean, some contractors just, especially we're still experiencing supply chain issues, mm-hmm. Especially for certain kinds of roof brackets and garage doors and dock doors. And some contractors just say absolutely not. Others, especially if you can point to an owner's obligation under the underlying lease, are willing to at least consider it. So usually it is an escalating penalty. So usually it's a certain amount per day. And you can also couch that as tied to a specific, dollar amount. So it actually is what the landlord slash owner would be charged under the lease. Otherwise, it can, another point of negotiation that makes it more palpable is a not to exceed. If it's a $16 million project, it is a not to exceed $400,000-$600,000 type of thing, because truly in business there are risks for everyone involved, and it isn't fair to have all of the risk allocated to one of the parties,
mm-hmm. especially right now when it's so unpredictable with what the next issue would be, especially in the supply chain.
I do feel like it's getting better. But yeah, still not perfect. Never really is.
Unpredictable.
I'm in 13.2.1.3. So this is termination rights under the contract. I would recommend, regardless of the party, adding a notice and cure period. Mm-hmm. That is, beneficial to both parties. So, also taking out 13.2.1.1, subsection 0.1 and 0.2. This is termination regarding issuance of a court order that requires work to be stopped. So almost COVID-like provisions. We're past that in the real world now. If that type of order goes on, it's up to the parties to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, it shouldn't just be an automatic termination right.
Mm-hmm.
13.2.1.3, and this flows through other elements of the contract and the exhibits. I'm fine with the concept of, especially if there is a termination for convenience or even for cause, the design builder is entitled to overhead and profit, but we always suggest benchmarks of market rates of overhead and profit. Right now, we're seeing generally not to exceed 10% of the work completed as a pretty reasonable benchmark for that.
I was just going to go back to when you said notice and cure period. That's them, the owner giving a notice and them having a chance to
exactly
cure.
Right. Yep. And usually it's short in time. Usually it's 10 business days or something like that to commence the cure. But with the understanding to the extent that cure reasonably takes more than 10 business days to complete, that period is automatically extended so mm-hmm. long as the design builder or owner, I mean, it could be an owner default as well. The party that is needing to cure the default, as long as they've commenced the cure and they diligently pursue to completion, that period of time will be extended.
Okay.
I'm in section 14.1.2. These are claims and dispute resolution. There is noted in that section a limit on claims. And if you are the design builder, you would like to go ahead and limit those claims. The standard contract limits it to 10 years after substantial completion of the work. States are all different. In Ohio, we have the statute of repose, which is 10 years from substantial completion. So when you're doing work nationally, if you're on the design builder side of things, certainly familiarize yourself on the applicable statutes of limitation in the jurisdiction you're working, but also push for a limitation in the contract itself in addition to whatever may be available by law. Conversely, if you're working with the owner, potentially seek just to give yourself all options within the applicable laws. Mm-hmm. So that is the contract itself. You'll notice in Article 16, it does define the scope of the agreement. So in addition to the agreement itself, it's listing the Exhibit A, which we'll talk about briefly. Exhibit B, insurance and bonds. Exhibit C is sustainable projects. I'll be honest, I don't do a lot with sustainable projects. I'm sure there's some people that specialize that, but my clients tend to, not participate in those programs. So let's go ahead and move into the exhibits. As I mentioned, we've been using multiple Exhibit A's at times. It just depends on the project, but it's a nice way of keeping things pretty simple and differentiating between scopes of work. Mm-hmm. So A, you'll see, is the really substantive important parts of the agreement, such as the contract sum. So it can be stipulated sum. It can be cost of work plus the fee. It can be the cost of work plus the fee with a guaranteed maximum price. I would say that's what I've been seeing the most as of late. Parties are in this kind of unsure times as far as it relates to the fluctuations in pricing, delays in materials, trying to gain as much certainty as possible. And you'll lay out the design builder's fee in a percentage. I mean, it can be a lump sum. It can be a percentage. I see percentage of the work, the cost of the work, the most frequently. And I see 3% or so as sort of industry standard. Mm-hmm. If you look into the next provision down, it's A.1, .4, .3, .1. This is the cost of the work and the design builder's fee. It's a sum. It's a not to exceed. This is the GMP. So giving the best calculation there, which is then included as an exhibit as well. You're going to want a very detailed breakdown of that GMP price. In the next section, A.1, .4, .3, .2, itemized statement, you're going to want to include that as an exhibit. The way I would recommend detailing that, being very specific, in that blank, see Exhibit A.1, .4, .3, .2, GMP summary dated X. Just being very specific. In your projects, you're going to have a lot of versions of documents floating around, and you want to make sure, to the best of your ability, everyone's working off the same version. Mm-hmm. So stating the date of the document is very helpful. And in the prior provision, you'll note what we had touched on, savings. And most of the deals I've been seeing is that any savings realized will be shared between owner and contractor on a 75-25% basis, so owner getting 75% of that, but the contractor sharing in the value at 25%.
So Exhibit A is sort of a wrap-up of all of the major dates, numbers, costs of the construction.
The dates are more fully fleshed out in A-141 mm-hmm. itself, but do pull through to this. It's the cost. The, mm-hmm. the cost, the allowances, the contingencies are all in Exhibit A. And that's what makes it nice. You could have Exhibit A1, A2, mm-hmm. and have all of that, all of those scopes of work separated. Mm-hmm. Exhibit B, which is the other definitely required component of the A-141, it is all insurance and bond based. And what I can say is I'm no insurance expert. I don't want to be an insurance expert. Mm-hmm. This is why it is so important to surround yourself with the appropriate professional services providers, making sure you have a good risk advisor on your team that can walk you through the requisite, you know, standard coverage limits to make sure if you're an owner that your project is properly insured because your design builder is carrying the right levels of coverage, or if you're the design builder, that you are properly covered in case something unforeseen, like casualty, occurs. So these are all fill in the blanks of different policies and policy limits, and I just always defer to the risk advisors on the appropriate amounts based on the project and just changes in the industry and kind of changes to standard coverages.
Yeah, and that's perfect. We have an episode on insurance, so if anyone needs to go listen to that,
perfect,
that should cover the insurance section.
And please note, it is standard for the design builder to include such insurance as a pass-through, mm-hmm. project-specific. So it's not uncommon for design builders to carry coverages that are umbrella, blanket in nature, but can easily be attributed certain percentages of that overlying policy to a specific project. So that pro rata allocated share is a pass through to the GMP.
Okay. Awesome.
Just the note is for some of the smaller contracts, so the contractor subcontractor A401 and some of the others, it is the A201 general terms and conditions that would be an additional exhibit to the contract, and it is long, and it is largely contractor and architect friendly. Mm-hmm. And if you are on the owner side of things, it is important to make some changes to it. There, as we talked about before, the need to put in some provisions relating to unknown or unforeseen conditions and allocation of risk between the parties for that. And Article 3.7, that's permits, fees, notices, and compliance with laws. That's a good section there to put those types of comments in. I actually really prefer, when at all possible, avoiding use of the 201 just because it's just behemoth. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like the A141 since it's a standalone document. But sometimes, especially for buildouts of a substantial nature, I mean, there are certainly commercial buildouts that can be, $10, $15 million or more. Mm-hmm. And you do need a substantial contract for that. So for some of those underlying contracts do require the 201. And then one other point, which we've touched on, delays and extensions. The standard provisions basically allow the design builder or the contractor to increase the GMP based on delays and things of that nature. Well, if you're on the owner side of things, that is not acceptable to you. But, usually there is an ability to create some risk allocation, and if there is truly something beyond the reasonable control of the contractor, one compromise I've seen is allowing a delay, but the contract price can only be increased for general condition costs, and that specifically excludes profit and fees, but it does include pass-through. So if, by way of example, the contractor has to be on site longer than anticipated due to no fault of their own, that the pass-through can be conditions costs required to maintain the job site and staffing of the work during periods of delay, including but not limited to compensation of the travel superintendent and per diem living expenses. And it's best practices to include an estimate on that cost. Fencing, utilities, trailers, that is usually the compromise, but you want to limit that and not just give a design builder a blank check to increase the contract price without the agreement of the owner, and that's usually an appropriate compromise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think You've given us a lot of great content for just AIA documents in general. So thank you for that. And it's easy for to kind of read through and just nod and be like, yep, I think I understand that. But so thank you for explaining it more in depth. But to leave us off, do you have any advice for the developing developers of the world?
Sure. I think it's twofold. I think, first of all, the importance of having the right team in place and knowing nobody can wear all hats. No one knows everything. And so the importance of having the right broker, the right risk advisor, the right engineer, the right architect, the right lawyer, the right accountant, it's of immense importance. And I know it can be daunting because good professional services providers are not cheap. But the cost of proper negotiation of contracts, of placing the proper insurance in place, of negotiating the substantive deal points and understanding the correct construction schedule and getting the right vendors in place, there's a lot of value to making the right decisions up front and avoiding problems after the fact. And what I would say too is you can't contract for everything. We could sit here all day and say what if, and at some point benchmarks such as using commercially reasonable efforts, you know, the parties negotiating in good faith. At some point, you have to sort of leave it at that because we just can't sitting. Who would have guessed in the beginning of 2020 that COVID would have occurred? Like nobody. Right. Nobody thought that. So there's always going to be something unforeseen, and you know, we need to just at some point put the computer and the pen down and just say we've gotten it as close as we can. We've anticipated as many potential risks as we can. We've tried to allocate those risks, as much as we can contractually. But that also is sort of why it's important to pick your partners in development, your owner partner, your developer partner, working with people you trust
yeah.
and you respect, and knowing if something crazy and unforeseen happens, you are going to work together in good faith to make it right. And the goal for these projects being once you get those teams in place, you can do a lot of great deals together. And once you – that's another, I think, really good point. Once you negotiate these agreements with a design builder partner and an owner partner, you got it. You know, you've spent the money up front to negotiate this document, but then you can do deals 2 through 100 and basically keep the contracts with the comments. Hey, we did that deal here last year. Well, it's the same. Everything worked out fine. Mm-hmm. Nothing new or unforeseen has happened. The comments are the same. We all agreed to them. That's what we're doing for the next deal and the deal after that. So there's definitely economies of scale. Once you get the agreements in place, you can use them. And so there's a lot of value to that. And then I would just say, reach out to those that have done what you want to do before. You would be surprised possibly how willing people are to help other people. I am in the place I am in my career because I have people such as Bruce Burkholder, John Lucas, J.R. Kern, people that came before me that were willing when I was a young attorney to sit me down and help me and answer my questions. And that's why I really thank you, Allie, for having me here. I feel like it's definitely my responsibility to give back the way people gave to me. I'm happy to help younger people, answer their questions. And you might be surprised. Real estate, I think, is a really, really great industry. It's hard. It's hard work. But I think it is a lot of fun. And I think it's a lot of really dynamic, fun people that like actually helping one another. And that's one of the things I love about it. So don't be shy to, someone you admire, ask them out for a drink or a cup of coffee or breakfast or lunch. And I think, 9 times out of 10, they're going to be happy to meet with you and give you some insight.
Yeah, that's all great advice. And that's one thing I've learned with this podcast is that people are always willing to help most often, and they want to help because we're all kind of in it together. In commercial real estate, we all want the best for the community and for Columbus. So yeah. I think that's great.
I think you just nailed it. One further comment and then we can, we can go. It is a very tight community in Central Ohio and commercial real estate. And so keep that in mind. What when you do good things, more good things will come your way. And don't be an asshole because you're the broker on the other side, the developer on the other side, the owner, you're going to work with them again. Mm-hmm. And so, keep that in mind. I think real estate should be and can be very collaborative, and it doesn't have to be adversarial. Good deals are deals that are beneficial to both parties. Mm-hmm. And just, keep that in mind. People like doing deals with people they like. And people don't like doing deals with people that are assholes. So
That's right. That's a great note to leave off on. So thank you so much again for walking us through this and for all of your knowledge. You have so much. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, Allie.